This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
At some point, our climate will change so much, it will be a whole new system, different from anything known in human history. But when? There's a paper for that. In 2013, a team of 14 scientists from the University of Hawaii published their work titled The Projected Timing of Climate Departure from Recent Variability. That was in the journal Nature. To learn more, we've reached the lead author, Dr. Camilo Mora. He's with the Department of Geography at the University of Hawaii and heads the Mora Lab. From Honolulu, Camilo Mora, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alec. Pleasure to be here.
Is it fair to say your paper asks when Earth will shift to a new climate?
Yes, that's the ultimate question that we wanted to answer with that specific paper. We know that climate change is happening, but unfortunately people don't really have a good sense of the timeline of when this is going to happen. Is this going to happen in 100, 1,000, 2,000 years? So on this specific paper, we were asking that question, when is climate change going to happen?
Okay, now the weather is always changing and the climate even has its rhythms. So what did your team use as a baseline for what we might call normal, or at least relatively normal?
That's right. So the word change means that something that we are used to is changing, right? So one of the things that we did for this specific paper was to quantify that, what is the things that we are used to. So for that, we used the temperatures for the last 200 years, and we look at all of the climatic variability of those 200 years. So that's pretty much the climate variability that we are used to. Then we took our climate models to project the time after which temperature exceeds any record that we had in history. And that's done for every pixel globally. So for every global pixel, we know exactly the time when these climatic models project that the temperature is going to be like something that we had never seen before.
So that's what you define as climate departure.
That's right. It's basically when the climate of a specific place moves beyond what the place is used to.
Well, let's not keep the kids in suspense. Suppose we manage to control our greenhouse gas emissions. By the year 2100, we go to only 538 parts per million CO2, and that's the 4.5 pathway developed by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So if we act on climate and follow that 4.5 pathway, when does the global near-surface air temperature cross the point of climate departure?
Well, that's one of the things that we found more remarkable about this one paper, is that the climatic changes that we are doing on our planet are so dramatic and so huge that even if we take action on climate change, the climate is still going to change. You know, and the way that we put this is like, imagine that you are in a highway and you are 100 miles per hour, full speed, and somehow you realize, oh, that, okay, this is too dangerous for me to drive at this speed. You can put your feet on the brake, and there is just no way that car is going to stop right away. That car, given the speed that comes with, has a momentum, meaning that it's going to keep moving forward until it finally comes to a resting point. That's exactly what's happening to the climate as well. So even if we stop climate change right now, our models projected that climate departure is still going to happen. In fact, the saddest thing of that paper was the fact that under business as usual, the whole temperature of our planet, all of the temperature of our planet will move to a new state by 2040s, in that decade of the 2040s to the 2050s. If we take action on climate change, that timing is delayed by some 20 years. So this is not to say that we shouldn't do anything, but we should just maybe start thinking ahead to prevent those consequences that will come from those massive changes in our climate.
Well, by my reading of your paper, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it looks like there is about a 14-year margin of possible error or change in your figure for that RCP 8.5, the worst pathway that we could take. And that would bring us a new climate as early as 2033 or just 16 years from now. Do I have that wrong?
No, you don't have that wrong. And in fact, there was a lot of controversy on these papers from the scientific perspective, given that uncertainty. And the whole analysis was repeated. And what we ended up finding out was that once you control for much precise uncertainty, that number is actually sooner, you know. So that's one thing. The other thing that happened with this paper is that it created a lot of controversy. And a lot of people just emailed me and phone called me to say all kind of nasty stuff. But there was a lot of other people that also emailed me saying, no, you are wrong because this is not going to happen in 20 years' time. This is already happening. And for instance, one of the phone calls this lady actually called me that I remember the most is this lady from the Niagara Falls. She said to me, look, I think that you are wrong. The reason why I think so is because those changes that you are pronosticating are already happening. When I was a child, I was used to walk across the Niagara River. That river was a time that was frozen. And today, there is just no way. I mean, you will drown if you dare to even get closer to that river these days. So those changes are already happening. Anyway, yeah, so going back to your original question, there was an uncertainty on these projections because we were using all of the models that were available, so there is always going to be that error, but that error actually was very conservative according to our estimations.
Well, we've been talking about near-surface air temperatures, the kind humans have measured for about 150 years where we live, but what about the global average sea surface temperatures? Does that hit a new state at the same time as the air or at different times?
No, that's later. Obviously, the water has more inertia. You know, you cannot heat up the water at the same speed that you heat up the air. So that is a variable that we usually have climate change happening later. The opposite is climatic changes that are easier to change, like, for instance, the ocean's pH. The ocean's pH has been stable for millions of years, and so because there is not so much variability, it's very easy for these small additions of greenhouse gases to move the pH of the oceans to a new state. So according to our paper, pH is one climatic variable that we already exceeded the variability of that one variable in the last 200 years. So we have different variables that will respond differently to this. So on one end, we have climatic change variables that had already happened, and some other climatic variables that will be lay in the century to change.
Well, Camila, we've been talking carefully about global average temperatures, and nature is never that neat. We know the progress and impacts of climate change are not evenly distributed. Where does a new climate arrive first?
So there are two important questions that you point out there to relate the questions. One is the fact that I agree that we have been looking at the means. And actually, these days, after that paper, we have focused more on the variability because actually what we are thinking right now is that it's the variability, the one that is the most dangerous. We are talking about things like heat waves, storms, hurricanes. Those are things that have very strong pulse effects, as opposed to things that are slower over time. So both of those things, the mean and the extremes, are changing. Now, the other way in which you can formulate this question is where is this variability going to happen the soonest? And what we discover, as opposed to what has been known, is that this climate departure is going to be happening earlier in the tropics. When you look at what is known about climate change, we always thought that the largest climatic changes are going to happen at the poles. That is correct. But unfortunately, the poles are used to a lot of climatic variability, so it's very difficult for climate change to move beyond what the variability is on that place, right? So the climatic changes that we are imposing on that system are equal or smaller or a little bit larger than the climatic variability on those places. The opposite happens in the tropics. The tropics are very stable, so very small changes in the climate will move the climate of the tropics to a new state. And that turns out to be a super dangerous condition for the tropics because by the same token, all of the species that are there, they are not used to any change at all. So as soon as you change the conditions on the tropics for a little bit, that will have massive ramifications for ecosystems. A good example of that are the coral reefs. Coral reefs these days, when you heat up the water just by just 1 or 2 degrees Celsius, during El Nino events, all of those corals struggle. Many of them bleach and hundreds of them just die. So now imagine what it will happen if you heat up the water of the tropics by 2 degrees Celsius. You completely exceed the levels of tolerance of many of these species there.
Now, according to the maps in the appendix of this paper, the point of climate departure comes a little bit later in Peru and a couple of decades later in Australia, and that, just as you talked about, seems odd to me from our experience because Australia seems to be at the front lines of climate change. They have record heat, they have massive land fires, droughts, flooding, and the corals dying. How can all these signs appear now if Australia is behind the rest of the world in climate departure time?
Yeah, so they are different. Again, that's kind of the, one of the ramifications. That's one of the things that we are studying right now. Unfortunately, the climate is a very complex interaction of climatic variables. So commonly, we look at just temperature, right? And temperature might influence certain countries, but not others. Unfortunately, as you just point out, the climate is related to other things like floods, sea level rise, hurricanes, and things like that. So basically, what the field is calling for is a more comprehensive assessment of these climatic changes altogether, and that's some of the things that we are working on right now.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Camilo Mora from the University of Hawaii. We're talking about the time when we depart to a new climate. Camilo, it's strange, but humans seem more worried about when the climate will be different than what it will be like to live then. Your paper did address that, at least by referencing other relevant science. What are some of the ways a changed climate could impact humans?
I mean, that question is massive. I mean, I just don't know why people don't get it. You know, like, I mean, climate is such an important thing to the livelihoods of people that it's just mind-blowing to me that we are tampering with that stuff. You know, and let me just give you some examples. Heat waves. Heat waves in 2003, there was a heat wave in Europe that killed over 50,000 people. Over 50,000 people died in 2 weeks. So this is like the September 11 attack every day for 2 straight weeks, just to give you a comparison of how bad the heat wave was. A similar heat wave happened 3 years later in Europe. There was one in 2010 in Russia. There was one in Chicago in 1995. And these heat waves are popping up all around the world, killing people like nobody's business. Australia is a case example where that happens quite a lot. Then you had hurricanes. The research, the knowledge is now increasing to suggest that the intensity of these hurricanes is associated with this warming already. And those massive storms that we are seeing in the Caribbean and also in the South Pacific are some examples of that. Then we had drought in California, Africa, for God's sake. People are starving to death and the whole ecosystem is incapable of producing the food that these people need. I mean, and I can just keep going on this. You know, there is an entire book over a few thousand pages long called the IPCC Report, where they documented all of these climatic changes and how they influence humanity. So it's just mind-blowing that we as a species haven't been able to comprehend how bad this is for us to tamper with that.
And as you said, your paper found the climate shifts first in the poorest countries and nearer the equator. To me, that suggests two things, unfortunately, in mass deaths due to the return of famine and disease, and mass emigration as people move towards a more survivable climate. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's another project that I wish we had more resources to do this, which is another thing, by the way. We got attacked because people say that we're doing this for the money. I just don't know where the people make those claims, because I would like to invite these people to come to my lab to realize that we are doing this out of just pure curiosity for knowledge, for this kind of stuff. But what you just say is totally true. If you look at where these climatic changes are happening, they're happening in the poorest countries in the world. That means a couple things. One is that action for climate change is going to be delayed because nobody cares about what's happening in those countries. You can see that, for instance, in scenarios like what is happening today in Syria. It's a total chaos, but nobody, no developed country wants to put their hands on that country. And that's, imagine now, what it will be for climate change when people is starving to death. My guess is that there is not going to be action being taken on this until these conditions start influencing the developed countries. And unfortunately, I think that that's going to be a delayed process. So by that time, it's probably going to be super late for us to fix this problem. But that's not to say, though, that the consequences won't be felt on developed countries, because my guess is that there's going to be a massive increase in immigration. So today we are very concerned about people migrating from Mexico to the United States. Just wait. Wait until the United States, until Mexico loses the land in Mexico loses the capability to produce agriculture, which is the major sector of job employment in that country. Now imagine what it will be when all of those Mexicans become unemployed and they had the United States just across the border offering all of these capabilities to improve their quality of life. My guess is that all of the people will try to cross there. You will have the same thing in Europe. Africa completely devastated by climate change. Guess what? All of those people from Africa is most likely going to continue migrating to Europe. The same thing happens in Australia. All of these people in Indonesia most likely are going to be moving there. So, again, for me as a scientist, it's just sad. that as a scientist, we haven't managed to convince the general public of how bad this is. Unfortunately, we are not there yet, but once we are there, it's going to be too late for us to take some actions on this.
And of course, we're just talking about humans picturing themselves. What happens to the land animals and plants when they encounter a different climate? And is that something that you study in your lab?
Yes, so that's something that we are studying in our lab. Unfortunately, if we don't care about what happens to the humans, of course, as a species, we are going to care much less about what happens to the species. And unfortunately, the species don't have an air conditioning for them to take rest whenever there is a heat wave. So unfortunately, those species are going to be the ones that will suffer the most. So the predictions that are coming out about the impacts of climate change on species are just devastating. I haven't done the work myself, but there are a few papers documenting this, like 50% of the birds, just to give you an example, could potentially lose the land where they live today because the climatic conditions where they are will become unsuitable from the climatic perspective for them to be in there. So those species will be forced to migrate. Unfortunately, many of these species are located on islands. So all of those species on islands are pretty much, that's it. I mean, there's just no chance for those species. They have no chance to migrate. And unfortunately, these climatic changes are happening way too fast for them to generate the necessary adaptations to cope with climate change. So, yeah, I mean, the picture for species don't look so good.
And then there's all the small creatures that are right at the base of the food chain that we depend on, the bacteria. I've interviewed several scientists about the impact of warming seas on plankton, and that's the basis of the food chain there and the source of half the oxygen we breathe. Do you worry about things like plankton and bacteria and how they're going to change along with this climate?
Yeah, I mean, that's not really my line of research. However, one thing that we study was the effect of oxygen depletions in the oceans. And we encountered on all of these simulations, I mean, this is already happening, and the models actually agree with that to some degree, the fact that the oceans are reducing the amount of oxygen. So this is happening for a couple of reasons. One is the fact that the patterns of oceans, the waters, the air circulation are changing. So the oxygen exchange is being changed, but more dramatically is the fact that there is a lot of decomposition in the bottom of the oceans, and unfortunately that's creating these massive areas of the world where there is just no oxygen for the animals to survive there. So it's creating these anoxic conditions, pretty much a whole areas of the oceans where the only things that can survive there are bacteria, and there's very few species that can survive under very low levels of oxygen.
So I have a couple of minor questions. First of all, what do you mean by sensible heat flux?
So when the energy comes from the sun, it can be divided into a couple, it can be partitioned into a couple processes. One is sensible heat and the other one is latent heat. So latent heat is when the heat gets converted, usually through the process of water evaporation. And sensible heat is just the energy that is trapped there, retained there. So imagine this like you are putting a water boiling, right? So you put the hand on the side of that boiler, the heat that you feel, that radiation, could be seen as a sensible heat, and the heat that is on top, the one that is evaporating, that will be called latent heat. And it turns out that had a huge implications for how different places on the planet will heat up. Because places that are very dry, those places don't have water to evaporate, so most of the energy that comes from the sun remains there as a sensible heat, and that's a heat that you just don't want. Usually that's what the ones that create these massive spikes in temperature during heat waves, while places that had a lot of humidity had a lot of latent heat, mostly in tropical forests and things like that. So all of the energy that comes there, that's the reason why they are cool, because the energy that comes gets evaporated and dissipated through latent heat. Unfortunately, those are kind of scientific terms that are complicated for scientists to explain to the general public.
I think I get it. And you do show a map showing precipitation changes, but that doesn't show a lot of change this century except towards the poles. And given the droughts and the flooding elsewhere, that surprises me. Can you talk to us about that?
Yes. So again, that's just the result of looking at the mean as opposed to the extremes. One climatic variable that is complicated is temperature. And in fact, on the paper somewhere, we make a caution about the fact that climatic variables that have a lot of variability, like, for instance, precipitation, is very hard for our approach to be applied to. Our approach is to see the time in which the climatic signal exceeds climatic variability. So if the climatic variability is very big, then the signal will be very hard to see. Even if the signal is there, it's very hard for you to separate the variability that is caused by humans from the normal variability that happens on that climatic variable. So our index, while it was very good for things like temperature, was not so great for things like precipitation. So our paper was not able to pick up the signal of climate change on precipitation. But there are ways in which this signal has been able to be identified on precipitation.
All right. Now, it sounds a bit harsh, but even if we do act quickly to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, this paper shows only a 20 to 30 year difference in the arrival of a new climate regime. So why bother if it's going to happen anyway?
Well, because the conditions, the things that we'll be exposed to will be twice as worse, you know. So either you hit a wall at 20 miles per hour or you hit a wall at 100 miles per hour. And that's the difference that we have to make when it comes to where we want to take action on climate change or not. I mean, humanity cannot expect that we have done this damage to our planet. We have destroyed over 80% of the surface of our planet. We have completely transformed it. We cannot expect that we are not going to pay consequences for it. The question is, what is the magnitude of those consequences? We continue damaging the planet, then we're going to pay more consequences for it. We're like a spoiled kid, if you ask me, you know, expecting that we're going to do all of this damage and things are going to be just fine. So that's kind of the message that we try to make from that paper, is that, yes, we are going to pay the consequences for this, but it will be twice as hard if we don't take action on climate change pretty soon.
Well, I guess another thing is, if we can delay the time of climate departure by a couple of decades, maybe that would give us time for carbon removal and storage. Do you think geoengineering will be necessary?
Well, yes, I agree with that. But the thing is that I don't know why humanity also wants to look into such a complicated strategy when we already had something that God put on this planet for us to fix this problem. Trees today are one of the main mechanisms, the only biological mechanism that we know that can sequester that carbon. Here in Hawaii now, we have over 80% of the land completely transformed as well. What we are doing here is trying to restore those ecosystems, for those ecosystems to sequester the carbon that we are producing. And it's possible. People say that it's impossible. It turns out that today, if you want to sequester the CO2 that you produce, the average American will need to plant an average of 20 trees per year. So how crazy is that? So we decided to go and look with school children from here, and we start planting those trees, and it's not difficult at all. In a couple of days, a couple of weekends, you go and you will take care of those 20 trees. And that's all what you have to do on a yearly basis. And all of the investment that we are doing, developing that technology, we can invest it on that kind of project, and we'll not only fix climate change, but we actually will do something that we can all feel proud about.
Well, let's say we got back to 350 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere, as Bill McKibben wants. It's hard to picture what that new climate with the brakes on would even look like. I mean, would the poles begin to refreeze? Has anybody, Camilo, been able to study what happens if we actually reduce CO2?
No, that's a question that seems so unlikely that I guess that's the reason why many people don't even study it. But curiously enough, we are actually doing some experiments today, seeing what will happen under those, should we achieve those conditions, how the planet will look like, especially from the species perspective. But the true answer to that question is that I just don't know. And I haven't come across many papers that have explored that possibility, just because the reality is so far off that it's hard for us to even think that we will go back to the historical conditions that we were used to.
Well, another reality that's hard to picture is the one that the IPCC says we're headed on right now, the RCP 8.5 path. It's 936 parts per million by 2100. That's almost, well, it's more than triple the pre-industrial levels. And I wonder if that's even survivable. Could we survive in a world that's 5 to 6 degrees C hotter?
Oh, no, there is no way. And actually, we had a paper right now. Had this paper, it's going to be published. I'm hoping that it will be published in the next month or two. It has gone through peer review, and we took all kind of empirical data. This is not model data at all. This is actual cases when people die during heat waves, to document the conditions under which people die. And the conditions are amazingly not that far off of the conditions that you see there today, which is the reason why people die in the first place, you know, because these very small climatic conditions exceed what people is capable of tolerating. So when you are talking about warming up the planet by 2 or 3 degrees Celsius, that's way beyond the conditions in which people have died in the past. And these conditions are going to be the norm in pretty much all of the tropical places, all the way up to maybe 30 or 40 degrees of latitude. So all of these tropics for humans will be unlivable outside. Obviously, my guess is that these people will adapt to it. We will buy air conditioning, maybe we switch from working during the day to work at night and take longer siestas. We will adapt to it, I'm sure of that. But the climatic conditions outdoors are going to be like climatic conditions that today are capable of killing human beings. And this is how serious this is, and why we get, at least I get so passionate about it, is because the only problem that we had is for us to communicate this knowledge better to people, because the knowledge is as solid as it can be.
You know, my sense of this paper is that it might take another decade to get even more research to be complete. We need a similar projection of the deeper ocean water and the stratosphere, maybe even into land storage and release of heat. What sorts of things do you think still need to be done?
So, I mean, obviously, we want, as a scientist, we want to justify our work, and we want to continue working this, and we're going to be tweaking these things to just like the first fund, you know. If you look at the principle of the first land fund, it's pretty much the same functionality of a high-end iPhone today. You can just talk to a person through a line. But obviously, there have been massive improvements on how you do that. So climate science is, I feel like it's on the same pathway. So we can get the principles of it, but we can potentially fine-tune much better those climatic models. And maybe we will never fine-tune those things. You know, for iPhones, as an example, keep improving all the time. The question is, do we wait until we get 100% certainty, or do we start acting right now? From my perspective as a scientist, I would think that we should do both. The science today is pretty good to suggest that we need to take a precautionary approach to this. I mean, the consequences of us being right will be just devastating for our planet.
We've been talking about the science of the coming new climate. The paper, The Projected Timing of Climate Departure from Recent Variability, was published in the journal Nature. You can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Our guest is the lead author, Dr. Camilo Mora, from the University of Hawaii in Honolulu. Camilo, thank you so much for sharing your time and your insight with us.
My pleasure, Alex. Thank you very much for your interest.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
You just heard Camilo Mora warn that extreme heat already kills more than terrorist attacks and will become very widely spread in the coming hotter climate. His team have a paper in review about that. I'm chasing another guest who has written related papers on the reality of heat making the world more uninhabitable for humans, mammals, and even most plants. In the journal Science in 2008, Dr. Matthew Huber wrote a technical piece which should be on the front pages of newspapers and news sites. The article discusses the problems in the limited tools to assess how hot it was in the great warming extinction called the PETM, the Paleo-Eocene Thermal Maximum, 56 million years ago. Without going into details, the methods analyzing the minerals and isotopes in specific seashells may have fostered a mistake. Scientists were puzzled how sea surface temperatures could show so low in these tests, even when the land air temperatures were killing hot. The idea was formulated and pretty widely accepted that some kind of thermostat regulated the gross amount of heat that could accumulate in the tropics. Matthew Huber says there is no thermostat. The tropics got so hot that a lot of plant life died off. The plants were so busy fighting off the heat, they didn't get enough photosynthesis to survive. That great die-off of tropical plants released yet another burst of carbon into the air. Global temperatures soared at least 5 degrees C, or 9 degrees Fahrenheit, for at least 200,000 years. We are talking about utter disaster that has already happened on Earth due to extreme climate change. Our guest Camilo Mora says a 5 degrees C rise in global temperature is possible this time around, but not really survivable for us. Then in 2010, Huber came out with another blockbuster in PNAS titled An Adaptability Limit to Climate Change Due to Heat Stress. We have no time to cover that now, but let me read a few lines from the summary. Any exceedance of 35 degrees C for extended periods should induce hypothermia in humans and other mammals as dissipation of metabolic heat becomes impossible. While this never happens now, it would begin to occur with global mean warming of about 7 degrees C, calling the habitability of some regions into question. With 11 to 12 degrees C warming, such regions would spread to encompass the majority of the human population as currently distributed. Eventual warmings of 12 degrees C are possible from fossil fuel burning. One implication is that the recent estimates of costs of unmitigated climate change are too low unless the range of possible warming can somehow be narrowed. End quote. I'm going to keep in correspondence with Matthew Huber in the hope that we can get him to explain. We all need to know.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Remember the nuclear power renaissance? It just died. Westinghouse Electric, the maker of a new design that was supposed to lead the future, has filed for bankruptcy. The multi-billion dollar cost overruns for nuclear plants now under construction in Georgia and South Carolina may probably be paid by the taxpayers again. Is it finally the end of this dangerous scam? Joining us now is Tim Judson, the executive director of the Nuclear Information Resource Service right near Washington, D.C. Tim, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. I appreciate you having me.
Okay, Westinghouse Electric. It's a household name and a legend in establishing the grid. Now it's going under. Who owns it?
Toshiba actually bought Westinghouse about 10 or 11 years ago. So, you know, while Westinghouse has always been thought of as an American brand and, you know, a lot of their nuclear operations are still headquartered here in the U.S., you know, they're actually owned by a Japanese corporation at this point.
The people promoting nuclear power, including Dr. James Hansen, always say just wait for the new Westinghouse AP1000 reactors. They will be much safer. What did the company claim was better about this design?
Well, they claimed that there were a number of advantages both to safety and to economics of these plants. And in terms of safety, they were developing a design that incorporated improvements in safety regulations that happened, you know, in the 1980s after the Three Mile Island and Chernobyl accidents that, you know, involved shifting from a reliance on safety systems that involved a lot of, you know, active mechanics, you know, like pumps and electrical systems, to having some more passive systems that could run when there was no power to the reactor, like a gravity-fed emergency coolant system and that sort of thing. But what we saw happen, among the things that we saw happen, were that after the Fukushima accident started in 2011, that, you know, again, you know, the regulators had to go back and revise their safety standards. And so there were some additional changes that needed to be made to the designs. And, you know, nuclear safety is always a moving target because for some reason, the accidents that continue to happen end up superseding what the industry thought was, you know, was adequate safety standards before.
It's always like planning for the last war, and then we get new surprises. So where are these new Westinghouse reactors being built?
So there are four being built in China, and there are four being built in the U.S. You know, there's eight under construction. They're all behind schedule and over budget. The Chinese reactors they're believed to be finished and coming online later this year and next year. But the ones in Georgia and South Carolina are all at least 3 to 4 years behind schedule now, and more delays could be coming. The first of those reactors in Georgia and South Carolina were supposed to come online in 2016 originally, having been ordered in 2008. And now the first of those reactors isn't likely to come online, even if their revised schedules are held to, until late 2019. And it's quite possible that that some of those reactors could still end up being canceled and their schedules pushed back until the 2020.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, with this bankruptcy, can we be certain the reactors already begun in the U.S. Southeast will be completed and become operational?
There's no guarantee at all of it. In fact, in the last week, both regulators in both Georgia and South Carolina have for the first time indicated that some of these reactors may not actually be completed. The Westinghouse bankruptcy has thrown the entire completion of those projects into question because, you know, one of the things that's driven Westinghouse into bankruptcy is that the cost overruns and the schedule delays in building these reactors have had to be partly borne by Westinghouse. And while Westinghouse has said that it's committed to finishing the projects that it started, there's no guarantee that, in fact, they're going to be able to absorb additional costs that are likely to come up in trying to get that job done.
Toshiba is a gigantic Japanese electronics company. Tim, why don't they bail out their own nuclear subsidiary?
Well, there's a question of the amount of debt that Westinghouse has gotten into and whether Toshiba could adequately absorb that. You know, Westinghouse has built up about $6 billion in debts through trying to build these reactors, and it might just be too big of an egg for Toshiba to swallow. So what started out as Westinghouse declaring bankruptcy last year has now potentially expanded into Toshiba potentially declaring bankruptcy as the parent corporation now, just a month later. And there are some serious questions about whether the Japanese government is going to have to, you know, is going to intercede in the same way that the U.S. government interceded in bailing out the auto companies 8 years ago. That may be the same sort of a thing happening with Toshiba.
Bloomberg reported just recently that Trump officials see a new national security issue in this Toshiba Westinghouse bankruptcy. The failure is so big and so dangerous that it's involved hurried meetings with Energy Secretary Rick Perry, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. It sounds like an all-hands-on-deck emergency for the White House. Why are they concerned?
Well, I would leave it to the national security establishment to figure out whether there are real national security implications to Westinghouse going bankrupt. I think what they're most concerned about is whether China is going to step in and try to buy Westinghouse to essentially support its own nuclear ventures and the completion of its own reactors. But if there's national security information that the Westinghouse possesses, then they might be able to block China from acquiring the company. Although there's already been a ton of technology transfer from the U.S. to China for these nuclear power projects that's already taken place. And China's already developed its own new reactor designs based on essentially copycatting the Westinghouse reactors. So, you know, if there are real national security implications to information that Westinghouse might have about nuclear science or technology, then they should just stop that acquisition from taking place if it comes up and let Westinghouse just go bankrupt and die.
Wow. Well, suppose the American government doesn't end up paying for the mistakes of this private corporation and to finish these reactors. Who will eat all the cost overruns or the money spent on reactors that might never even open?
Well, that's a little bit to be decided. One of the factors that's in play is a financing provision that was created in the 2005 energy law, whereby the U.S. government offered up to $18 billion in taxpayer-guaranteed loans for the construction of these reactors. The two reactors that are being built in Georgia have received about $8.3 billion in this taxpayer financing, essentially what's called a loan guarantee. That would allow, would essentially, you know, if the venture goes bankrupt or the company that owns the reactors isn't able to pay the loans, then essentially taxpayers would absorb that loss. Essentially, the loan would be, you know, would be forgiven, and taxpayers would have coughed up $8 billion without getting it repaid. The project in South Carolina actually didn't take advantage of that financing, so there's no taxpayer loans from the U.S. federal government in place. But in both states, what's really making both of these projects happen are state legislation that's called construction work in progress. And anybody who you should watch out for these kind of provisions in your own states, because what they essentially do is authorize the utilities to bill customers for power plants that are being built but aren't operational. And so, in effect, something like up to 20% of the electricity bills that people in South Carolina are paying right now are for construction costs of these two reactors that are still only about 30% complete. You know, there's billions of dollars more to be spent on these things. And the same thing is happening in Georgia.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg. You wrote something called Too Big to Bail Out: The Economic Costs of a National Nuclear Power Subsidy. Tim Judson, tell us about some of the ways the public is paying big private corporations these hidden subsidies for nuclear energy.
Sure. Well, the nuclear power companies have been going around the country the last couple of years talking about how there's an unlevel playing field where natural gas prices are cheap because of fracking, and renewable energy is unfairly subsidized so that people can sell wind and solar for cheaper than what nuclear plants can pay. The reality is, you know, that this is a really self-serving argument. Nuclear power has been one of the most heavily subsidized industries in the country for decades. And the current nuclear power plants were built with massive subsidies from federal and state governments. And they also include things that are sort of non-subsidy subsidies, like, for instance, the fact that nuclear power companies don't need to obtain private insurance to cover the cost of a nuclear meltdown, like happened at Three Mile Island or Fukushima. Essentially, the taxpayers are insuring those nuclear plants against accidents by essentially limiting the industry's liability, and taxpayers could end up paying for hundreds of billions of dollars in the case of a nuclear accident. Taxpayers are also ultimately going to be responsible for managing the nuclear waste that nuclear power plants generate for, you know, that's toxic for hundreds of thousands of years. And there's also, you know, other major costs like the cleanup of uranium mining sites where, you know, we have very lax environmental laws regulating uranium mining, and we have 15,000 abandoned uranium mine sites across the country that have never been cleaned up, and there's no provision yet for that to happen. And most of those uranium mines are in Native American communities, so there's a major environmental justice issues all around in this. These are all ways in which current nuclear power plants are subsidized, and a lot of the costs are being borne by the public and by the environment. But now, with these current reactors all becoming old, the average age of a nuclear power plant in the U.S. is 36 years, and more than half of them are older than 40 years. So these reactors were only licensed and expected to run for 40 years originally. And that was why the U.S. government, you know, made a point of trying to inspire the nuclear renaissance to start building new reactors to replace the old ones. Well, with the failure of the nuclear renaissance and the fact that building new nuclear reactors is not possible or desirable in the U.S. right now, the industry is trying to keep these old reactors going. The problem that they're having is that the cost of operating old nuclear reactors is skyrocketing because of the amount of maintenance that they require and the very high expenses for components and doing this kind of maintenance work on these old plants. And so, you know, while energy prices have gone down, while the demand for electricity has gone down because of energy efficiency improvements, while renewable energy is growing at an increasingly fast rate because of the improving economics of renewables, the economics of nuclear power are going down the toilet. So now the industry has been pushing for more subsidies and bailouts for these old reactors, new subsidies for old reactors. And they started proposing these subsidies in 2014. And, you know, people at the state level were very effective at stopping them for those first 2 years. Unfortunately, the industry was able to get Governor Cuomo in New York to ram through a bailout of astronomical proportions last year, $7.6 billion for four aging reactors. And in Illinois followed suit on the heels of that. So that essentially, you know, two states are now on deck to subsidize old reactors to the tune of $10 billion. And they're taking these proposals to other states where there's now bills, you know, potentially being in play in Connecticut, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, and potentially other states to come. This is an issue that's of, you know, sort of massive, you know, national implications. And what's really outrageous about it is these same reactors were bailed out 20 years ago to the tune of $80 billion on their bad debts for building these nukes. And the idea was that by bailing them out 20 years ago, we were supposed to be free of consumers bearing the risk of nuclear power, the economic risks of nuclear power going forward. And here we are 20 years later, as the industry is on the verge of going out of business, with another round of bailouts that could essentially divert billions and billions of dollars away from clean energy investment into propping up old nukes.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Tim Judson from the American nonprofit watchdog called NIRS. And we're talking about the huge bankruptcy of Westinghouse Electric, the nuclear power subsidiary of the Toshiba Corporation. Well, Tim, the Toshiba Corporation isn't alone drowning in nuclear debt. What is the situation with the French nuclear power builder Areva?
Sure. Areva is, like Westinghouse, one of the flagship nuclear corporations in the world. Areva is a state-owned corporation, about 80 to 90% state-owned by the government of France, alongside Électricité de France, which is the French nuclear utility, which operates nuclear power plants. Areva has been sort of the contractor arm of the industry in France that designs and builds reactors, that mines and processes uranium, that reprocesses and manages nuclear waste and that sort of thing. They're also active in the U.S. and nuclear projects here as well. So Areva was, like Westinghouse, one of the flagship companies that was supposed to start this nuclear renaissance with new reactor designs that were supposed to be safer and more economical. And Areva actually went down the tubes faster than Westinghouse did. So Areva has been building two new reactors in China, two new reactors in Europe. They had proposed a few new reactors in the U.S. Again, like Westinghouse, All of those projects are billions of dollars above budget, years behind schedule, even further behind than the Westinghouse reactors are so far. And so Areva essentially went bankrupt last year, and essentially the company has been carved up to where EDF is now, Electricité de France has now absorbed some parts of Areva's company, and then other parts of Areva are essentially being left to go fallow. And so what you have right now between Areva and Westinghouse, these are the only two corporations in the world that have been able to commercialize nuclear reactor designs that have actually been able to market and export new reactors and start building them. Both of these companies are going down the tubes because of what a failure building new nukes has become. And there's no one else on deck that's proved, you know, any other nuclear corporation in the world that's even proved able to get as far along as they have. So what's happening in nuclear power right now is sort of like if all of the major car companies went out of business and you couldn't buy any new cars. That is actually happening to nuclear power right now, where every company that has actually been manufacturing new reactors is on the verge of going out of business.
What about the British plans to build a new reactor? Is that going ahead even as wind, solar, and gas are way, way cheaper?
Well, what's happening in the UK is sort of on the tail end of all this. So there's a project called Hinkley Point C, which is a project to build two new reactors at an existing site in England. And so that was a project where Areva was contracted to build two of these new reactors, like those that are under construction in Europe and China. The feasibility of that project has been incredibly bad, from the start. And the projected cost of building it has varied from between $30 billion and $40 billion for two of these reactors. And in fact, you know, until the new government was elected in the UK last year, there were expectations that Hinkley Point was going to go down the tubes, in part because of all the problems that are facing Areva and the French nuclear industry and their ability to finance the project, but also because of the improving economics of renewables and the fast rate of growth of solar and wind in the UK. The Theresa May government has essentially decided that they are going to prioritize nuclear over renewables, and the Areva board of directors and the EDF board of directors have decided that they can't afford to let this project go down the tubes yet. And so they've essentially created some incredible measures to be able to make Hinkley Point move forward, including a 30-year commitment by ratepayers in the United Kingdom to buy this electricity at twice the market rate of electricity in the UK right now. You know, it's questionable whether that project is ever going to be completed. They haven't really begun construction yet. And so there's at least, you know, probably, you know, 5 to 10 years, you know, along the way for Hinkley Point to, you know, to go belly up in the same way that the projects in the U.S. seem to be.
You know, in my opinion, this has never been a business. It's always been a kind of a scam, as I said at the beginning of this program, to suck money out of the taxpayer and some executives make big money, but the public ends up poorer in the future. Now, history is quite clear that the nuclear power industry was developed to keep materials and skills flowing into the nuclear weapons program. Does the Pentagon still need civilian nuclear power?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you think of the government's policy on nuclear weapons. You know, if we were really committed to a policy of disarmament in this country and, you know, in the phase out of nuclear weapons, then there's not much argument for keeping a whole another side industry going in order to provide the technology and expertise necessary to do that. But what some British researchers did last year was they actually did a study to figure out why the British government was so committed to this Hinkley Point project. And they did surveys with policymakers and people in the industry, and the paper that they published concluded that the real thing that was driving the government's commitment to new nuclear power plants in the UK was wanting to be able to have the technical expertise and the industrial capacity to keep their nuclear submarine weapons program going. And so I think that probably the same is true in the U.S., that there's, you know, a deep institutional commitment within the federal government. The Department of Energy's primary business is managing the nuclear weapons complex, and there are now proposals to fund the revitalization and development of our nuclear weapons program to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars over the next several years. And so I think that there's that probably the same dynamic is in play here.
As you know, President Obama was friendly towards nuclear power. Some say he got campaign money from the industry. What have you heard about Donald Trump's relationship with the nuclear power industry?
Well, there's not much to be said about his past relationship. I mean, he's made favorable statements about nuclear power in the past, and he certainly made some very troubling comments about nuclear weapons and our nuclear weapons program that suggests that he's very supportive of improving and increasing our nuclear arsenal. And so that's one of the concerns that we would have, is that a Trump administration, with its commitment to dirty energy and to propping up dirty energy industries like coal and natural gas, that they could view nuclear in the same way, as well as see it having a national security interest in propping up nuclear power. It would be a terrible mistake to do that.
Well, now that America, France, and the UK, and many others are stuck with this nuclear power mess, is there any sane plan to get out of it?
Well, there's no plan by the U.S. government to get out of it. In fact, that's one of the things that we've been trying to bring to people's attention in questioning these bailouts that have been going on, is that essentially the energy industry, and from the federal government down to state regulatory agencies and policymakers, and in the very communities that these power plants are in, have been whistling past the graveyard on what's happening with nuclear power. We had a meeting with the Governor Cuomo's administration in New York over 3 years ago to inform them that the economics of these nuclear power plants in New York were going down the tubes, and that, in fact, these reactors might close early. And it was relevant because the state was developing its next six-year energy plan, and we thought that they should be aware of it. They're planning on these nukes being in operation, that they needed to reevaluate that. And they should also be prepared for the industry to start coming to them for, you know, for subsidies in order to keep these plants profitable. We were virtually laughed out of the room with the idea that the Governor Cuomo, who was, you know, was trying to build a reputation as an advocate for clean energy and was working to shut down the Indian Point nuclear power plant near New York City, that he would ever consider subsidizing nuclear power. Well, what happened just 2 years later was that the governor was not only going along with a bailout, but he was actively pushing it. And what was really motivating that going on was essentially the industry making, you know, really serious threats to close nuclear power plants immediately, like within a matter of months, and potentially facing the governor facing a political problem with job losses in parts of the state where he's politically vulnerable. And what we see across from whether it's in New York or Illinois or these other states, what's driving the push for bailouts is that states have been asleep at the wheel, not paying attention to what's going on with nuclear power, assuming that these plants are always going to be cheap and they're always going to be there. And then companies like Exelon and Entergy coming forward with threats to close plants in a matter of months and not knowing what to do politically about the loss of jobs and property taxes and local economic impacts. I mean, there needs to be a plan, and I think there are, you know, organizations like ours that are working on helping states develop plans to deal with reactor closures. But in terms of at the policymaker level, at the states and at the federal level, there's been a complete unwillingness to actually deal with this problem. And we know what's happening with coal. Coal plants have been closing over the last several years. You know, it's a well-understood trend that the coal is on its way out. People have not anticipated that happening with nuclear, and it's really caught policymakers by surprise.
Well, let's say there is a major nuclear accident in the United States, heaven forbid. The public demands an immediate shutdown of all nuclear plants. Do the lights go out, or are there enough other sources of power that we could cope somehow?
Sure. I mean, one of the problems that the nuclear industry is having in the U.S. is that we actually have an oversupply of electricity generation capacity. The competition to sell electricity on the markets is so stiff because there's such a huge supply that prices have gone down significantly. I mean, it's always a local question whether if a particular power plant shuts down, you know, whether you need to take some measures to compensate for it. But, you know, on a national basis, I think you can look to Japan and see what's happened there to get a clear sense of it. You know, Japan was more dependent on nuclear power than the U.S. is before the Fukushima accidents. And essentially overnight, Japan went from 30% nuclear power to zero, and effectively has been at zero for the last 2.5 years. And the lights haven't gone off in Japan. They have struggled and managed to keep the lights on through things like energy efficiency and energy conservation. But, you know, renewables are growing at a pretty stiff clip. And what you see, you know, the interesting story about Japan versus a country like Germany, where they're planning where they're doing a planned nuclear phase out, is that in Japan the nukes went off overnight, and you know, but the utilities have billions and billions of dollars invested in these plants, and they don't want to have to write them off and declare bankruptcy. And so the utilities have been getting in the way of what's the obvious solution to Japan's energy problem, which is that they should be investing in wind and solar and energy efficiency dramatically. But the utilities have been getting in the way of that and blocking renewable energy politically in Japan. The same problem could happen in the U.S. The U.S. public could turn, against nuclear power if there's another accident and demand that the reactors be shut down. But very powerful energy corporations could still interfere with having a plan for alternatives.
For a couple of decades, you and I have been fighting off craven nuclear promoters like Bjorn Lomborg and the Breakthrough Institute and well-meaning Greens like James Hansen and Mark Lynas. We said the nuclear industry is super dangerous, badly regulated, bound for bankruptcy. Now that's all come to pass, but it doesn't really feel like a win. People are saddled with risky rundown reactors and hundreds of billions more public debt. Tim Judson, is this a case where nobody wins?
Well, I mean, the path to winning is clear. In a sense, the way that the energy industry and the utilities in particular have managed to stall progress on the clean energy transition for decades has been by pitting consumers and environmentalists and labor against one another, by preventing the clean energy alternatives from coming to the fore, and by making the kind of political threats about job losses and everything else, and skyrocketing energy prices and blackouts and that sort of thing, for far too long. And so I think the propaganda that the energy industry has created for decades makes it seem like there's a zero-sum situation. We've got to accept, environmental pollution, nuclear catastrophe risks if we want to have our lights on and our energy cheap. The opposite is true now. I mean, the advances that have been made in energy efficiency and renewables and now new technologies like energy storage and smart grids and smart energy management mean that we're actually on the cusp of being able to completely transform our energy system over the next 10 to 20 years from one that's based on these dirty centralized power plants that are causing climate change and nuclear waste to a completely clean energy system that could actually rebuild our economy and save the planet. So the reality is just that, it's an inconvenient truth for the energy industry that the solutions are here.
Give us a brief snapshot of your group, the Nuclear Information Resource Service. What is it?
Sure. So we're an environmental group that was founded in 1978 to essentially be the nationwide information center and networking hub for grassroots activists across the country who are concerned about nuclear power and radioactive waste. So we have a small staff, but we work nationally supporting, groups at the state and local level to be informed and engaged on nuclear issues and to run national campaigns when necessary, to be able to bring about the end of nuclear power and to ensure that communities aren't contaminated with radioactive waste.
We've been talking with Tim Judson. He's the executive director of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, or NIRS. You can find them at nirs.org. You can also find more links and news stories about the Toshiba Westinghouse bankruptcy in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Tim, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.